Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon. On our program today, nothing new to fight inflation in Minister Freeland's much-touted new affordability plan.
But these are all measures we built into our last two budgets.
We are receiving lectures on inflation, not action.
New inflation problems, but old inflation solutions. Why did Minister Freeland offer nothing new in her so-called affordability plan that was not already in the last budget? Was it more about taking shots at Pierre Poilievre? MPs are debating the so-called new affordability plan to fight inflation. Then Trump's who knew what when. Which members of Trump's inner circle knew about the plan to try to overturn the election results? Why did the Vice President, Mike Pence, refuse with day three of the January 6th insurrection hearings going on? We will get the latest from Washington. All that plus what to do about hate online. A judge weighs in. What is the new plan from the former Chief Justice, Beverly McLaughlin, of the Supreme Court? Will politicians listen to her? She joins us with her view. It's fascinating. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players.
The measures in this affordability plan represent entirely new support for some of the Canadians who need it the most right now. $8.9 billion that they did not receive last year. This is new money for the Canadians receiving it this year. But these are all measures we built into our last two budgets. These are measures that have already been accounted for.
The speech he's giving is supposed to help Canadians dealing with inflation. The reality is there is nothing new in her speech that's actually going to help people in a real way today.
So what is the definition of new? It's new money, but it's an old promise because you'd already planned to give the money, but now the money's going to be new. Look, with new inflation challenges, pressure has been on the federal government to come up with new solutions. And expectations were raised by the government itself today. It was supposed to be a new $8.9 billion affordability plan. That's literally what the finance minister, Chrystia Freeland, called it. But hold on a second. Let's try to fact check that. There is literally nothing new in the plan. There's not a new dollar allocated. There might be new dollars received. There's not a new tax break. Nothing today that was announced wasn't already put in the last budget or the previous budget. It was essentially a giant rewarmed burger disguised as a fresh $8.9 billion patty. So if the plan wasn't new, what money, which will be new to some Canadians, will there be? Now, if you forgot the last budget, let me remind you. There is boosting of the Canada Workers' Benefit, where a worker could receive up to $1,200 this year. Yeah, that will be new money, but it was already in the last budget. The government's $10 a day childcare deals with the province. That'll be new to some people. But we already knew that. The 10% increase in old age security payments, that was announced in budget 2021. A one-time $500 payment for low-income renters, we knew about that. Starting this year, there'll be dental coverage for children under 12 from families earning less than $90,000. Hold on, that's worth a double fact-check pause here. Remember, the Fed's allocated $5 billion to that particular promise in the last budget. That was their dental care promise. But today, the Parliamentary Budget Officer actually costed the promise at actually over $9 billion, almost double. In any case, there's other things in there, adjusting key government benefits to inflation like OAS, the Guaranteed Income Supplement, and the Canada Pension Plan, the Child Canada Benefit, and the GST credit. Look, I'm not trying to minimize these things. It's a lot of money, but we knew they were coming. And is that enough to deal with the new inflation challenges? But in her speech, Minister Freeland tossed some shade at Conservative leadership candidate Pierre Poilievre. She didn't mention his name, but we knew who she was referring to. And his promise to fire the Bank of Canada governor over the inflation crisis. She said that's highly irresponsible and economically illiterate to undermine the bank in an era of global economic volatility. So the question is, should the finance minister have introduced actually some new solutions, new tax cuts to the new inflation problems, or is all the issues in the last budget good enough? Let's bring in a panel of MPs to debate. The National Revenue Parliamentary Secretary, Peter Fradjikakos, is here. The Deputy Finance Critic, Adam Chambers, is here for the Conservatives. And the NDP Whip, Rachel Blaney, is here. Mr. Fradjikakos, let me start with you. Why did your government dress up a speech as a, quote, new affordability plan? You know there was literally nothing new in terms of the ideas. I know some of the money's going to flow, but we knew about it in the last budget. Are we to assume that nothing economically has happened, the war in Ukraine, the inflation rates are higher, nothing's changed that your government is not already can do in the last budget? Is that what we're to assume?
First of all, Evan, thank you very much for having me. I would say that we have to take a step back and look at the situation. Canadians are having a very difficult time right now. We recognize that. Fuel prices are higher. Food prices are higher. And Canadians need the government to continue to be there for them, just like it was during the pandemic. And we remain steadfast in that commitment. The question is how exactly to proceed. And you've reviewed the suite of measures that were announced today in the finance minister's speech. To your point, these are measures that had been announced but not yet enacted. They are now going to be enacted. Canadians will be able to see the benefit. Seniors over age 75 will see more income, 3 million no less. The Canada Workers Benefit will go exactly to those who are in the title, workers looking for support from their government. Child care, dental care for kids under the age of 12 in low-income families earning less than $90,000.
These are a suite of measures that matter. But, sir, I understand that the suite of measures, and we did cover it extensively during the budget. I guess my point is, today there's a big speech saying this is a new affordability plan. But it's not new. Like, we did see all this stuff in the budget. It was a review. And my question to your government is, given the new pressures on inflation, it's higher than your government thought, new disruptions because of the war in Ukraine on pressures on food, higher gas prices than anybody imagined, an interest rate hike from the Fed in the United States of 75 basis points. You still feel your government is comfortable that the plan you had months ago is still good enough for today?
Based on where we are right now, Evan, I think that the measures do make sense. We have a historically low rate of unemployment at 5.1%. Canada has recovered 117% of the jobs that it lost when the pandemic began. We are in a very good position in terms of our debt-to-GDP ratio. However, we do realize the need to act. The measures announced today that will be enacted, as I say, have the best chance at impacting Canadians directly and quickly. We saw over the past few weeks and months opposition standing in the way of the budget passing. We were able to finally move that ahead meaningfully, and Canadians will see the benefit. Of course, if things continue to take turns and we need to react, the government is prepared to adjust. We always have been. We've shown that through our record, particularly during the pandemic.
Okay. Well, this week we saw a Manulife survey indicating one in four homeowners might have to sell their house if interest rates go up. Mr. Chambers, what did you make of the plan today? Did they miss an opportunity, or is this actually in their last budget, were they kind of ready and prepared? What's your sense of this?
Well, if we think back to the budget, Evan, in April, this was a time when the government was still telling Canadians not to worry about inflation. And now, today, we're being told that the measures that they brought in when they told Canadians not to worry about inflation are actually going to help with inflation. Now, some of these measures are indeed benefits to Canadians that are indexed to inflation, so they were going to go up anyway. But some of them don't actually kick in until next year. And that's why Conservatives have been calling for immediate relief for Canadians in the form of, you know, tax holidays or rebates. You take gasoline as an example. About 60 cents a liter of gasoline goes to taxes of various levels of government. That is immediate relief that could be provided to Canadians. By the way, gasoline and energy prices are one of the significant drivers of inflation. So what we're saying is, look, you need to realize that facts on the ground have changed and show a little bit of humility to say, okay, maybe we need to course correct here. It's okay for the government to say, listen, we underestimated inflation like other governments around the world have. Just last week, President Biden wrote a letter to the American people saying, look, we were behind the curve. We have a plan. But this plan from the government is actually nothing new. It's the same playbook from a couple months ago.
I hope I get a chance for a rebuttal there, Evan.
Yeah, sure you can. But let me hear Ms. Blaney first. Ms. Blaney, should the government have brought in either A, new spending, or maybe tax cuts like cuts on the gas tax that some have called for?
Well, it was really shameful, in my opinion, to see this government repackaging. Canadians are suffering. There are a lot of folks that are worried about putting food on the table. You mentioned earlier, Evan, that a lot of them are worried that they're going to lose their homes. Inflation is having a huge impact, and it's having an impact on the working people of this country. And so the NDP has been very clear. Let's get money in their pockets as quickly as possible. You know, we have the GST, which 12 million Canadians across this country received the GST rebate. Why not get money to people by doubling that and making sure that they actually can afford some of those higher expenses? So the programs that they have in place right now that they're, again, repeatedly saying again and again but not doing will help in the long run, but people can't wait for that. They are struggling right now. So let's get money in the child tax benefit to people. Let's get people some money with the GST, and so that they actually have the resources to go out and purchase the things that they need. This is real life, and I feel like there's a huge disconnect of everyday people of this government. They don't understand the urgency. I don't know how many reports that they have to see and when they're going to see this as an urgent issue that means that they have to take action. You know, I love the child care program. It's something the NDP has been fighting for a long time. It's going to make a huge difference, but it is undermining the fact that people in our country are in a crisis today. And if there was money and the GST rebate, they would have money to deal with those crises a lot sooner.
Mr. Fitzpatrick, I know you want to respond, but GST rebate, cutting the gas tax, why not give Canadians a break now, a new break, not something that you'd already planned months ago?
The main benefits are indexed to inflation. That is an important point to recognize. And
it's $7.
I would say let's be serious about this $7 figure. It came up in question period today. The Canada Workers Benefit for an average family of a working family, it will see up to $2,400 in added support for families with kids in childcare by the end of the year. Their fees will be reduced by 50%. Their fees will be reduced by 50%. The plan of the NDP is to increase taxes on oil and gas companies, something that they haven't even consulted the provinces on. I wonder how Rachel Notley, for example, feels about that.
To Mr. Chambers' point, it's a windfall tax. They're making extreme profits right now while Canadians cannot afford to pay for their food. It's about who you value, everyday Canadians, or do you value people who are making billions of dollars in profit?
If I can just finish, to Mr. Chambers' point, sure. To Mr. Chambers' point regarding the thing, you know, taking off tax in terms of gasoline, it doesn't really do much because we don't know where gas prices will go. The war in Ukraine continues to rage on. Moving ahead by supporting Canadians through the benefits that were announced today and that will be enacted is a much more fruitful approach, one that will yield genuine outcomes in terms of people's lives. If you want to get support
but,
to
I mean,
people,
you can't
this is the
say,
way to do
I mean,
it.
I'll just give quick, Mr. Chambers, because I got about 30 seconds. Just reply that. Mr. Fitzpatrick says getting rid of the gas tax won't do anything.
No, I didn't say that. I said the chance of that is minimal compared to the effect of that is minimal compared to the benefits that will, yeah.
Well, I mean, I think you'll have to try to explain to Canadians why they're paying 60 cents a liter to various levels of government in taxes, and that if a government reduces those taxes, that companies won't all of a sudden pass on that tax break. I mean, that's a pretty serious kind of accusation to say that they'll be price fixing in the Canadian oil and gas and fuel markets, that Canadians won't see that break. I mean, we've seen other jurisdictions around the world actually do this successfully. Canadians are very highly taxed, and we even tax on tax. We put HST on top of the other taxes already. So I think Canadians fundamentally would recognize and believe if governments reduce taxes on gasoline, that would be passed through. And I think that's an immediate benefit that can be passed on to Canadians starting tomorrow if the government wishes to kind of revisit its plan.
It's so volatile, Adam. You can't look at it that way. Gas prices are so volatile, you can't look at it that way.
Peter,
well, why don't you have the carbon tax kick in?
And Rachel, there's a lot on this. Look, I'm happy to keep having this discussion, and I think, sadly, we will have to because affordability is not going anywhere. But I really do appreciate the three of you joining us and debating these ideas, which we need more of. Thank you so much. But I do have to get onto this. Can you trust the government to regulate online speech? What can actually be done about hate speech online? Fascinating intervention today from the former Supreme Court Justice Beverly McLaughlin. We have a one-on-one with her next. She's a co-author of a new report on the subject, and she's got ideas of how to do it, she says. Let's find out what they are next. Stay right here with PowerPlay.
Most recent events have shown that the priority was put on the parliament buildings, and not so much on the Supreme Court building. And so, I would hope that the Supreme Court building will be considered as a priority in terms of safety and security.
So that's the Supreme Court Chief Justice Richard Wagner on security. It's interesting, right? Has the so-called Freedom Convoy, that's what they called it, or the trucker protest, changed security needs for the Supreme Court in Ottawa? Well, it's something I want to find out from our next guest, who actually Mr. Wagner, Chief Justice Wagner, replaced. She knows a thing or two, or more, about the court. She's now weighing in on the online platform and online speech regulation. She's arguing in a new paper that the federal government needs to regulate the system, not the speech online. What does she mean by that? How do you combat hate speech online? Well, she's working with a group of citizens from across the country to give the government recommendations to protect online speech while fighting disinformation and hate. It's a question, obviously, that's plaguing the federal government's Bill C-10. Do you remember that? Critics were slamming that bill, saying it could restrict content creators and be muzzling and censorship. That controversial bill has been revived as the Online Streaming Act. That's coming up. Debate about that. But critics still say this bill could overregulate user-generated content, platforms like YouTube and TikTok. Can there be a happy balance between online regulation and protecting online speech? In this area of new security at the Supreme Court, do judges need more protection? Let's find out. Joining me now, the former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada, Beverly McLaughlin. She also co-chairs the Canadian Commission on Democratic Expression. First of all, what a pleasure to have you on the program, and you're taking a break from writing your incredible spy novels, actually, which are pretty cool, at least detective fiction. You're part of this group of Canadians from across the country who are trying to create a list of recommendations for the federal government to protect democratic expression online and address harmful content like disinformation and hate speech. This is very prescient. You know the federal government's under heavy fire today in Parliament on something called Bill C-11, right, which some say is restricting content. And is there a way to regulate social media and still protect freedom? What's the balance?
Well, you've hit the right word when you say balance. And long before we were in the digital age, our law said and continues to say that, one, you have freedom of speech. That's guaranteed by the Charter. But you cannot use that way in that speech, that freedom, in a way that's going to seriously harm others. And that is where the balance comes in. And the courts have struck this balance for many decades with different legislation, hate legislation, other kinds of defamation, different kinds of law. And now we face a new challenge, which is how do we affect this balance in the digital age?
You write in part of your group that there are basically two ways to do it. One, basically to say, like Germany does it, once something's posted, oh, I saw hate speech, go get it. And you're saying that's the wrong way. We got to get it upstream. How do you do that?
Right.
How do you do that?
Yeah. So that is the takedown model. And it sounds attractive, but it's really difficult. First of all, you have to get the platforms to decide in advance what they're going to take down, and new forms of speech are always cropping up, or you have to have a regulator to tackle it after it's out, get it down after it's done harm. A lot of problems with it, and it can be very intrusive on free speech, because you just know if you're sending speech around that you might get caught by this draconian curb that's just going to take you offline before you even have a chance to explain or say why you think you should be allowed to say that. So free speech critics don't like that model, and I actually think it faces huge problems in implementing it. So we gave this a lot of thought, and we think the second way is the best, which is to incentivize platforms with some sanctions at the end if they really don't comply, to incentivize them to be responsible in what they allow to be spread and amplified by the internet and the various platforms they provide. And so the idea here is that you attack the problem from a systemic basis. And we all know the systems are based on algorithms and they choose what to amplify, et cetera, et cetera. But you can put regulations and laws and incentives in place and work with the platforms as well to try to ensure that some of the worst harms are not being amplified.
Right. A couple of quick issues while I have you. Earlier today, as you know, the Chief Justice, who replaced you, Richard Wagner, spoke to the media. We're just talking about trust and hate speech. He talked about protection for the Supreme Court. He hopes it's considered a fundamental building to protect following the protest, the trucker convoy. What does that tell us that new security for the court is needed? Is that an important issue because of the new environment right now that even chief justices of the Supreme Court or justices on the Supreme Court are concerned?
Well, he knows what's going on better than I. It's been over 3 years since I was there. So he is the person who is in the best position to assess this. We do know that first of all, let me say that historically, judges and courts haven't been big targets of terrorism or people who are dissatisfied. And we have, for our courts in Canada, they enjoy pretty high public confidence rating. So I don't think it's a huge problem, although I defer to Chief Justice Wagner on that insofar as he would have better information. But I would say that there are some risks that have to be monitored. We saw that a stalker recently has been charged in connection with threatening the life of one of the United States Supreme Court justices. And so all of the justices had security when I was there. And I think we have to be vigilant about that. And it just takes one person who is upset with a decision or whatever to do a terrible thing. And we have to go against that.
And speaking of vigilance, the Supreme Court, you mentioned the Supreme Court in the United States, they have that leaked draft opinion to overturn the key Roe v. Wade abortion decision.
Yeah.
That rocked the Supreme Court. Does the Canadian court need to be vigilant against leaks like this and politicization of the court?
Oh, yeah. Well, we're not politicized in the way the United States Supreme Court is. The justices on the Supreme Court are chosen independent of their politics. And so we don't have that atmosphere, which is terrific. Yes, when I was Chief Justice, I was always concerned that we not have any leaks. Sometimes the cases are very important. Sometimes they involve a lot of money and could affect stock market and so on. So we were always very, very careful, and I'm sure the court continues to be very, very careful. But this was quite shocking to everybody in the judging business, if I can put it that way, because the United States Supreme Court had never had a leak either. So why it happened, we still don't know, and at least I don't know, and we need to make sure for the credibility of the court that there aren't leaks like this.
I like that expression, by the way, the judging business. The former Chief Justice on lots of different things, including regulating the system, not the speech, when it comes to the regulation, probably one of the most hotly debated topics today. Thank you. What a pleasure to have you back.
Lovely to talk to you, Evan. Thank you.
Let's get to some other news you need to know right now. An update on that nearly $100,000 Governor General in-flight catering bill. Statement from the Department of Defense is now saying that the originally reported price tag was just way too high. It actually says it's not actually $93,000 price tag for the three dinners, three breakfasts, two lunches, and various snacks for 29 passengers and 17 crew members on board. 93 was the amount sent to Parliament following a question by a Conservative MP. But the Defense Department says, no, the actual bill and the receipts for the bills and the cost of catering only totals $80,367.19. Does that make you feel better? This includes the meals, the delivery, the handling of catering, and the flights. They also noted that when traveling, quote, catering services are only available from select providers as defined by various airports and local authorities with costs that are fixed by these vendors. And it makes you think, maybe I should get into the catering business on airports. And the House of Commons vaccine mandate lifts next week. There was a unanimous consent in the House today to end the mandate on June 20th, the same day the government is lifting mandates for domestic and outbound international travel. Coming up, we'll head to Washington, D.C. in the investigation into the January 6th insurrection. How did the Vice President Mike Pence fend off Donald Trump's pressure to overturn the Biden election win? Who knew what went inside the Biden camp, or inside the Trump camp, rather? We'll get details next. Stay with us.
Our investigation found that immediately after the president's 2:24 p.m. tweet, the crowds both outside the Capitol and inside the Capitol surged. The crowds inside the Capitol were able to overwhelm the law enforcement presence, and the vice president was quickly evacuated from his ceremonial Senate office to a secure location.
The U.S. committee investigating the January 6th Capitol Hill riot convened for a third day of public hearings today. Under the spotlight today, the former U.S. President Mike Pence, more specifically the former President Donald Trump's attempts to pressure Pence into rejecting the 2020 presidential election results. What else happened today? Let's bring in CTV's Richard Madden with the latest. He is in Washington. Okay, Rich, what did we learn about the Pence-Trump saga that day?
Yeah, we got a real insight into what happened the morning of January 6th from former Vice President Mike Pence's own top allies and legal counsel. And it was jaw-dropping to hear this phone call between President Trump and Mike Pence. Just a little bit of context, Evan. We know leading up to January 6th, the president ignored his top advisors, including former Attorney General Bill Barr, instead listening to just this cascade of characters, including Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell, insisting that they have this plan to overturn the election. All of these court cases were tossed out, except they had this one Hail Mary, and that was concocted by Trump's lawyer, John Eastman, to get Mike Pence to decertify the slate of electors. Mike Pence refused, so we heard what happened on this phone call between Trump and Mike Pence. And this was these were descriptions from his own family, Ivanka Trump, calling the conversation was heated. In this call, Trump called Pence a wimp. "I do not want to be your friend anymore." He called him the P word. Mike Pence still refused, and that is when the former president unleashed a mob on the Capitol to storm the Capitol after calling on Mike Pence and trying to intimidate and pressure him to overturn those elections results or decertify them. And it was pretty wild to hear this from inside the Pence camp. We also saw, Evan, never before seen photos of Mike Pence whisked away in that undisclosed location here on the Capitol. There's a photo of him looking at a smartphone, reading one of the former president's tweets as a mob was chanting, "Hang Mike Pence." At one time, we learned that mob was 40 feet away from Pence in that undisclosed location. So it's pretty jaw-dropping to hear that the former vice president's life was in jeopardy, or safety was in jeopardy.
Pence advisor, retired Republican Judge Michael Luttig, testified today. Now, what did he add to this investigation?
Yeah, so he was one of the people testifying, part of Mike Pence's legal counsel, when they were reacting to this crazy conspiracy led by John Eastman that Mike Pence had the power to decertify. We heard words like crazy, nutty. Are you out of your effing mind for John Eastman to continue to push the president to go ahead with this idea that Pence had the power to overturn the election? And here is what he had to say when he laid the line in the sand that when he told Mike Pence whether or not this he had the power or this was constitutional. Take a listen to this.
"I would have laid my body across the road before I would have let the vice president overturn the 2020 election on the basis of that historical precedent.
Now, Judge Luttig is a dyed-in-the-wool conservative. He has conservative credentials, and he is one of the many conservative voices we heard from. And that's a deliberate strategy, Evan, by Democrats on this committee. People saying this stuff aren't Democrats, they're Republicans. And Luttig left one ominous warning at the end of this committee hearing, saying that if Donald Trump returns or one of his anointed ones, this could happen again in 2024.
Hmm. Well, that's obviously... One of the questions everyone's raising right now, CTV's Richard Madden.
Yeah.
Just extraordinary hearings, day three in Washington. Thanks, Rich. Coming up, the affordability fact check. Will Chrystia Freeland's non-announcement make life more affordable? The former parliamentary budget officer, Kevin Page, jumps into the debate. It was supposed to be new announcement, new stuff. There's nothing new, but will the new money that's finally going to flow make a difference? We'll find out next. Stay with them.
Inflation is not a made-in-Canada challenge, and it's actually less severe here than among our peers. Inflation in Canada was 6.8% in April. It was 9% in the United Kingdom, 7.4% in Germany, and 9.2% across the OECD. In the U.S., it was 8.6% in May.
Okay, when it comes to the race to get ahead of inflation, the rising cost of living, the Liberal government is maintaining its current speed. At the wheel for the Feds, Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland, and she's saying that we've got a new affordability plan. It's $8.9 billion. The problem is there's nothing new in it. It was all re-announcements from previous and announced measures laid out in previous budgets. We knew it was coming. So she says, oh, no, but the money's new. That's true. They're finally being implemented, so people will get more money. But we knew all about this back in April when the budget was first set. So we knew about the government's $10 a day daycare plan. We knew about the boost to workers' benefits. We knew about the boost to old age security. We knew about the one-time $500 payment for low-income renters. The money received is new, yes. But why brand this as a new $8.9 billion plan to pull ahead of inflation? Is it just spin, repackaging, and will it do anything with the new reality when inflation is worse than they thought? Well, the press guy is going to break this down. CTV National News Bureau Chief Joyce Napier is here. Freelance reporter Justin Ling is here. And our special guest is the former parliamentary budget officer, Kevin Page, now president of the Institute of Fiscal Studies and Democracy. All right. New problems, old solutions, Kevin Page. We'll get to the politics of it, but the substance of it. We knew everything this government was doing from the last budget. What did you make of the new affordability plan? Is it up to the new challenges to fight inflation?
Yeah, it's not a new plan, but it is a significant amount of resources that is new in terms of monies that will be in the economy in 2022 that were not there in 2021. So in that sense, it's monies that are needed. It's targeted to, you know, some people would make the case, the minister made the case, to vulnerable people, which is good in this particular environment. And I think it raises the broader question of what is fiscally responsible in an economy that is growing, that a labor market that is relatively strong, and inflation rates that, you know, that are running in that sort of 7% range.
Joyce, Mr. Page is right. You know, it's a weird stagflation-y kind of situation, right? You got high inflation, but you've got a tight job market. You've got some households with a lot of savings. So they basically said, you know, nothing's new. They tried to slap a bow on the budget again and re-announce it. But is it prudent or is it just spin?
Well, I mean, it's a little bit of both. The pressure was on. The pressure was on not only by the opposition, who a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about that, Evan, had, you know, presented to the minister solutions. Mr. Singh saying, you know, a redistribution of wealth, go after those companies that made oodles and oodles of money during the pandemic. The conservatives saying, oh, why don't you just take the GST off fuel? Gas prices will go down, suspend the carbon tax. There were all sorts of, you know, suggestions out there that we didn't hear the liberals react to it because the finance minister was really not talking about it. This is the first that we hear from Chrystia Freeland in several weeks about this, except the answers that she gives in the House of Commons. So the real question, I think, here, and probably Kevin Page could answer that better, is really, is there anything the government can do to bring those prices down? Because that is what is hurting Canadians. We've talked to Canadians today. Look, she was at a hardware store, Chrystia Freeland, before going to give that speech, and she heard businesses saying, you know, people are not spending money here because they've got to spend it on food and on gas. So is there a solution? I don't know. The government is making a lot of money because of inflation and because of the high cost of fuel. Maybe bring down taxes. How about you bring down, give Canadians a break, put more money in their pocket at large. There must be a way to balance the money they're getting in with the money they won't get in with these taxes. There's got to be something you can do, a more immediate solution that is not earmarked in your budget that I'm sure the opposition, especially the conservatives, would be totally in favor of.
Justin Ling, I mean, there's a policy question, there's a political question. From the policy point of view, they didn't take immediate measures, but they had raised from the political expectation, sort of expectations that this was going to be new. What do you make of today?
I think there's a really, really complicated policy question here and a really, really simple political one. I mean, the complicated bit here, and you heard Chrystia Freeland talk about it this afternoon, is the fact that a large element of this inflation is due to really extraordinary circumstances. You know, obviously the pandemic, but new waves of the virus in China causing lockdowns and production crunches, droughts and heat in India, the war in Ukraine disrupting both gas, oil, and wheat out of both Ukraine and Russia. This is all causing huge supply crunches, but you know, there's also problems here, hangover COVID-19 protocols causing labor disruptions, a tight labor market like you mentioned. I mean, not to go too Econ 101, but you know, inflation is too much money chasing too few goods. We still have a ton of money in the market, and we have a real problem making goods, getting them to market, getting them on ships, getting them on trains. Some of that is either this government's fault or things this government can address, removing some of those COVID-19 measures. It's probably prudent at this point, bringing in new workers, not just skilled workers, but folks who can do sort of entry level jobs. It should be a priority. You heard her talk about that a little bit earlier today, but also, you know, some of these tax credits she announced, some of these benefits she announced is going to worsen the problem, including first-time homebuyer tax credits, which is just plowing more money into a really overheated housing market. So this government's approach is sort of madly off in all directions. Now, why is it that? Here's the simple political answer. They're trying to do the opposite of whatever Pierre Poilievre's talking about these days. If Pierre Poilievre's going hard on reducing spending, on you know, raising interest rates, on getting money out of the market, well, they're just going to keep doing what they're doing because it lets them drive yet another political wedge that they're going to use to form their next majority government.
Mr. Page, just last word real quick. I mean, what do you make of the opposition calls for something more immediate? That the Liberals' plans, some of them are indexed to inflation, they're long-term child care, but some, the pinch people are feeling right now, today, yesterday, are they prudent or are they window dressing these kind of cuts to GST on fuel that Joyce was talking about?
No, it's I think those are policy responses that you know that the government will consider, like, you know, potentially at this inflation, if we go from 7% inflation, we're going to get new inflation numbers next week. We could be talking next Wednesday about inflation number well north of 7%. You know, if we, you know, because of the situation with these, the, you know, supply chain related issues, if we saw inflation go to 8%, 9%, I think those kinds of measures in terms of, like, you know, adjusting taxes might come into play. But I think in this current moment, you know, with the economy still growing relatively strong, with, you know, with the unemployment rate down, in the 5% range, with a deficit of $50 billion a year, I think the government, you know, said we front end loaded a lot of our measures. We're going to repackage this. And that's the prudent thing to do at this moment in time. But if, you know, if we see inflation rise much further, like closer to 10%, we're going to need other measures.
Yeah. Yeah, I just think it was an expectation game. The expectations were raised so high, and then they didn't deliver anything new. So now they're sticking to it. Kevin Page, that's a political, not a policy issue, though. Kevin Page, thank you, sir. Joyce and Justin, please stick around. Just before we take a break, we got breaking news. If you're into the World Cup, FIFA has announced Toronto and Vancouver as the Canadian host cities for the 2026 World Cup. Canada is co-hosting with the U.S. and Mexico. 10 matches will be played in our country. Let's start with Toronto's BMO Field, part of a nearly $300 million bid that will require upgrades and adding more seats. The city has asked the provincial and federal governments to help split the cost. There's always a bill here, folks. Meantime, Vancouver says it will spend as much as $5 million to host the games at BC Place. Disappointment, though, in Edmonton. Not selected today, despite hosting matches at the Commonwealth Stadium at the 2015 Women's World Cup, which is too bad. In the Central, we thought Edmonton might get a shot there. But good news for Vancouver and Toronto. That's going to be great. And a lot of debates about the politics of that World Cup as well. Stay with us. Another battle in the Tory leadership race. This is crazy. The party's investigating an allegation from the Polyev team about the Brown camp. Will the big blue tent tear itself apart before voters elect a new leader? We're going to dig into the allegations. Press gallery's next. Stay with us. Polyev versus Brown, the Conservative leadership race is just getting nastier. Today, one of Pierre Polyev's national campaign co-chairs, Tim Upple, wrote a letter to the Conservative Party's leadership election organizing committee and alleging that his campaign has now received reports that, quote, organizers working for the Brown campaign were arranging to reimburse the membership fees paid by individuals who agreed to join the party using the Brown campaign's web portal. In other words, pay your $15 to join and we'll reimburse you plus, they allege. Brown's team says, no way, our campaign is not paying for memberships. Nobody acting with the authority from our campaign is paying for memberships. He says, we look forward to refuting this transparent tactic from the Polyev camp, desperate to stop their loss of momentum. The Conservative Party's executive director says that the Conservative Party has received the complaint from the Polyev camp, and they are investigating the allegation. So what does this mean for the Brown camp, the Polyev camp? Let's bring back the press gallery. Joyce Napier, our bureau chief at CTV News, is here. Melanie Paradis is a conservative strategist. Most recently, the DCOM for Aaron O'Toole. And, of course, our good friend Justin Ling, freelance journalist and multi-talented guy and author, is here as well. Mel, what do you make of this? This spat between Pierre Polyev and the Brown camp and allegations of basically cheating.
Well, it's nothing new from these two teams, unfortunately. I mean, they've been fighting pretty viciously back and forth since the start of the race. The Polyev camp has been pretty clear that while they have what appears to be a strong lead right now, they have no interest in giving any inch up. And so they're going to keep up the attacks. I think it's going to be a long, hot summer of attacks like this.
Justin, I talked to them. You know, the Brown camp says, oh, it's a sign that the Polyev camp is desperate, and the Polyev camp, it's a confirmation that the Brown camp is dirty. What do you make of it?
Well, I mean, all sorts of things can be true at the same time. I mean, the reality is Patrick Brown has this stink of shady membership sign-up practices haunting him from his days running for leader of the PC party. I think there's clearly tons of smoke and at least some fire there. I mean, I don't know that it's true this time. Evidently, there's going to be an investigation, but there has certainly been some less than totally above board practices in the past. You know, on the flip side, I mean, it probably is true that Pierre Polyev is feeling the pressure from losing a little bit of momentum. What's more, he's made it very clear he wants to not just win this race, but win it decisively. And if that means taking out the two men running behind him, neither of whom are in caucus, both of whom are probably not going to run if they lose, I think he's more than happy to do it. But that being said, You want to talk about losing momentum. I mean, Patrick Brown is losing endorsers and staff left, right, and center. And the word on the street is that he's lost some just in the past couple of days to some premier aspirants out in Alberta.
Yeah, well, Michelle Rempel-Garner, who was one of his keys, is now Joyce seriously considering running in Alberta, so she's going to leave his campaign.
Absolutely. But, you know, I'm going to go back to Pierre Poilievre, because now he has called both his opponents, Mr. Brown and Mr. Charest, corrupt. And they're hurling insults at each other. I mean, to us, it's, you know, almost entertaining. Look, we understand that this is a galvanizing race. 600,000 memberships. I mean, I don't know, Mélanie will be able to say if this is unprecedented, but those numbers are actually huge. The question is, how many of these 600,000 members will actually vote? Last time it was only 42%. This time, because of, you know, the entertainment factor and the fact that these people do make headlines, and look, they are interesting, contenders. In the end, they may be, you know, fighting each other and hurling mud and worse at each other. But they're keeping their party interested.
Yeah.
I think this is a party that is engaged. And what more do you want in a hot summer when people don't pay attention to politics? Well, you know, people are going to be paying attention. So if attention is what they want, they're getting it.
Yeah, well, is it a circus or is it actually really significant here, Mel? What's the takeaway from all this?
It is both, I agree. But I think that actually the most exciting part about today was Michelle Rempel-Garner, possibly, just the possibility of her running for the leader of the UCP gives me chills. I was very disappointed when she chose not to run for leader federally for the National Party. I think that she is one of the most important and effective and meaningful voices in our movement, in the conservative movement in Canada. And I think that she will, she loves Alberta. She will fight for Alberta. She was an incredible health critic during COVID. I can only imagine with the Council of the Federation is meeting in a couple of weeks. I can only imagine what she would be doing at that table as Premier of Alberta. And honestly, she's the only one who can beat Rachel Notley. So I think that she's going to be a massive contender in my eyes.
Well, and we'll find out if another federal politician can make it in Alberta. Prentice, Kenny, maybe Michelle Rempel-Garner. Joyce, Justin, Mel, unfortunately, I got to go. That's it for your Power Play Day in Politics. We'll be back in 23 short hours. Hug your loved ones. We'll see you tomorrow.